From spooky legends past, down through generations, to haunted locations that hold a ghostly past. Come one, come all, come finders and seekers, hear the creepy side of NEPA.
Welcome to the creepy side of NEPA. I am Dan Kozlowski.
And I'm Nora Herchick.
On tonight's episode, we have an interesting pair of ghost investigators who are using new technology with ghost investigating and doing live ghost investigations on YouTube. Joining us now is Jason from JP Videos and Alan from The Revenge of the Apocalypse. Welcome to the show, guys.
Hey, thanks for having us tonight.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming. So how did you guys get started with the whole ghost investigation thing?
Well, for starters, for me, I've been into the paranormal investigations for the better part of a decade, going back to probably around 2004, 2005, when I experienced my first type of evidence experience in person. And it made me curious as to what is beyond the afterlife. And after doing some research and buying some equipment, started doing my own kind of private investigations, just my own curiosity, started going to local reported haunted spots. And since that time, I've experienced a lot more than I've ever imagined I ever would. And teaming up with Alan from Revenge of the Apocalypse, we're able to work together as a team, doing both live paranormal investigations in both private residences and general haunted areas. And we've captured and encountered and experienced some pretty remarkable stuff. And the great thing about it is that when it happens live, you guys see it firsthand. It's not anything that's thrown in with editing or special effects. It happens real and on the spot. And with Alan teaming up, he records for his channel and has cameras rolling while we're live. And he's able to go through and edit and make a video showing any activity that he captured from that particular investigation. And together, it just seems to work out. We've been doing it for a better part of a year, but I've been doing, like I said, solo investigations for about 15 years now.
Now, did you and Alan know each other before the whole investigation started, or did you guys meet through like ghost investigating?
Well, we met, I hosted what was called a meetup event. Periodically throughout the year, I do host public meetup events, which gives viewers and other content creators a chance to meet myself and others at a particular location. And I met him, I believe it was 2 years ago, if not mistaken, at an abandoned school in Shenandoah called the J.W. Cooper School. He attended that event. We met there, started talking, found out we have a lot of similarities in both, you know, the types of filming that we do and paranormal investigations as well. And we decided to kind of collaborate, and the rest is history from there.
So you guys said that, you know, obviously you do these videos and they're all live. Have you guys ever had any of your viewers comment and say, you know, that they saw something in the back of the video, or, you know, that they heard something on the recording that maybe you guys didn't actually hear in person while you were there?
Actually, that happens quite often. And that's another positive thing in doing it live, is we have a lot more eyes and ears. Typically, when I go live, I have anywhere from 200 to 400 people watching live. And obviously, I can't pay attention to everything at all times, but a lot of people will chime in live during the chat saying, hey, I saw, you know, an orb over there, or I heard a voice, you know, and we're able to kind of, on the spot, look into what maybe caused that, or see if we can replicate it. So having the viewers live is just more eyes and ears to help pick up anything. And when we do it, though, the way I do it, and Alan can agree, is that we try to disprove things. So if something does happen while we're investigating, whether it's a noise, a sound, any type of evidence, we try to find out what the cause of it is, like a natural cause. If we can't, at that point, we do have to consider maybe something paranormal. So, but having viewers chime in live is all part of it, makes it even better.
Yeah, I know a lot of ghost investigators sort of do the same thing. They try to debunk what they saw, but you guys sort of take it to a different level, I think, doing it live as opposed to people just presenting the evidence that they found.
Doing the live really validates what's going on. So, like, if you have, and honestly, a lot of TV shows that are out there have already been labeled as, you know, being bogus with doing things. But, you know, if it was just me, myself, recording a video and editing it, it would be the same kind of deal where people would say, you know, it's fake, you're staging this, you know, what have you, when the camera's off. But the fact that I'm doing that and then he's also doing it live, it really comes together and shows that there is really nothing hidden. There's nothing that could possibly be staged. because you're literally getting a full real-time experience, you know, seeing it firsthand for yourself.
Yeah, it's almost like you're bringing all of these other people, although, I mean, obviously not physically with you, but they are able to come along with you guys on the journey, sort of, virtually.
Exactly.
Now, as you're investigating, are you guys able to interact with the viewers? Like, if they say they see something live, are they able to say, like, send a comment to you guys saying, like, oh, look behind you, that sort of thing?
Yeah, because when I stream, I'm streaming live on YouTube on my channel, and it's a real-time live stream. So I'm able to see the viewers' comments, and I'm able to read their responses and interact with them almost like a Skype call or like a video call. But
right.
Obviously, we can't see them, but we do have a real-time conversation. There's maybe about a five-second delay, but otherwise I'm able to acknowledge their comments, answer their questions, and potentially look for something that they may have noticed off camera or in camera that we didn't see at the time.
So what are some of like the tools that you guys bring along with you in order to do these investigations?
Well, I could say our tools have grown as we've been doing this. Starting off, probably the simplest thing is an item called a K2 meter, which is also known as an EMF detector. It picks up electromagnetic frequencies or radio waves, and it's a great tool because it's inexpensive and has been documented to be very, I guess you could say, solid as a piece of equipment to use for investigating the paranormal. And all it is a device that has different LED lights on it that light up from green to red. And if you go anywhere near, like, bad electrical work or even your cell phone throws off electromagnetic frequencies, it sets it off. But typically when we go to locations, we're off in the middle of nowhere with no source of energy, and we get hits on this equipment, on this piece of device. And it shows you that something is causing it that we can't see or nothing that can be explained. Aside from that, I do use a simple mag flashlight. And the way that works is just by adjusting the flashlight with a twist on. It's a twist on and off switch. And we adjust it so it's just barely off, barely on. And we leave it sitting on the ground, and on its own, the flashlight will turn on and off. And we use those two tools, at least myself in particular, for communicating with the afterlife. We're able to ask questions, and they're able to make those lights light up with yes answers, yes responses. And we ask them to leave it off for no question or no answer. And there's been countless times we've had real-time conversations with something that we can't see, hear, or feel, but is responding to our questions, and most of them are pretty responsive within a matter of seconds. Those two alone is what I traditionally carry. I also have a temperature gun to scan temperature readings. We look for cold spots. Obviously, having an open mind is the most important, but Alan could explain. He actually has some more, I guess you could say, sophisticated and more higher-end gear that he recently purchased that he could talk about next.
So some of the stuff that I use, we actually do both have a laser grid, which is another tool that actually has, in two occasions, worked really well, which is, it looks kind of like a pen, and when it's set down, it actually has a bunch of little green dots that will just display on the wall or, you know, wherever it's aimed at, and if something were to pass through it like a figure, you will actually see the dots moving, and you'll actually see the shape of if somebody's standing there or if somebody's walking by or walking towards you. The two times that we've had an incident happen with that, it is probably one of the creepiest events because you can physically see something right there. So that's something that both of us, we do carry that. I also have a thermal gun. So I'm able to see, you know, the heat signatures, and if there's a cold spot, a hot spot, and it will actually take form to if something's there, which, one, it works good for, you know, doing temperature reading, but then also seeing if there is, you know, a figure. But also in an instance where we were alone, kind of in a wooded location where we really thought we were being stalked by an actual person, you know, having something like that, if there is an actual person out in the woods or in the area that we can't see with our own eyes, having a piece of equipment like that is also kind of good for safety as well. Another piece, my biggest things are the infrared camcorders. Even if it's pitch dark with the camcorders that I have rolling, I have some that are placed down, and then I have one that I have in my hand at all times. I'm able to see everything going on, so I'm not blind. by the darkness. We don't have to have a flashlight on to see anything, because the infrared light, you can't actually see it. If you look into a infrared light, it'll look red, but there's actually no beam of light that comes from it, like how like a flashlight works. Another thing, which we haven't had any success with yet, is a diode. Now, this is a small little device that it actually plugs into a microphone. And then from the microphone, I have it plugged into a Bluetooth speaker, because the theory on this diode is that it will not pick up any ambient sound. So anybody talking, a bird chirps, somebody makes a footstep, it won't pick up any of that. It is only supposed to pick up a paranormal voice. We've used it twice so far, haven't had anything happen with that yet, but I'm keeping my fingers crossed that, you know, one of these days that ends up turning out to be a very useful piece of equipment. And then the last thing that I'll mention is the doll that I carry with me. We like the idea of having a toy, because it's something that, especially if it is a young child, which actually during one investigation, which I think for both of us, I can say really, you know, stuck with us, was interaction we had with a child. And having a toy is something that's a little bit more comforting, because, you know, to a child that has passed away at a young age, somebody coming to try to talk to them, you know, it could come off as a little bit scary. You know, if they're old enough, they're taught not to talk to strangers and, you know, things like that. And that's all stuff that we would like to think carries on in their memory when they do pass on and they're an entity. So having a toy is something that's a little bit comforting. So that's something else that I like to bring with me.
I think you're the first person that we've had on this show that has mentioned bringing something like that, like a toy or something, to try and kind of comfort any spirits or entities or anything that they experience.
I agree. That sounds very interesting to me.
Yeah, because the idea is, like, we try to be respectful. You know, a lot of people that ghost hunt, they will antagonize. You know, they do it just for a thrill. They're not doing it with the purpose of, if there's this spirit in this house, and, you know, you got to figure, even if it's just, let's say it's a living being, you know, if you're somewhere and you're lost and you're scared, you really want someone to be able to find you and help you. And doing paranormal investigations, because we do that, you know, and because they're a spirit, we may be their only chance they actually get to have the comfort and be able to go on to where they need to go on to. So we really try to go into these places like, okay, we want to see if something's here. And if it is, how can we help it? How can we make things right in the way they should be? Not just be like, oh, you know, haha, we had this scary encounter, you know, and this happened and that happened. You know, we really want to try to make it a peaceful situation.
So you're not just there for the entertainment value. You're also there to try to help.
And one thing I will say is that there's probably hundreds, if not thousands, of channels on YouTube that do paranormal investigations, and it's a small percentage that we're included in that does it live. And that's because a lot of the channels, I'm not going to say that it's on accident or that it's on purpose, but there is evidence that is manipulated, and it's just been known to happen both on TV shows and on YouTube channels. And the whole reason is because they want people to stay engaged. People want to see evidence. They want to see activity. And when you're doing paranormal investigations, it's not like a circus show or a sideshow. They're not going to perform on command. It's if they feel comfortable doing it. And there's a lot of times we do investigations where nothing will happen, and there's nights where it's nonstop. And that's why the whole reason is for doing it live, to show that we are not manipulating it, trying to trick people, trying to fake anything. It's raw and real, and nothing happens. Nothing happens. If something does, you see it with your very own eyes, just like we do. So I think that makes us stand a little bit apart from the others that are out there doing it. But obviously people do find it entertaining, but we are there with good intentions to try to help something or someone that is maybe lost or, you know, needs some guidance or something like that. And the one thing that works great for both of us is that I'm kind of a skeptic, and Alan is actually more sensitive. He's able to feel emotion. There's clear evidence in a video where he actually was like violently ill, and also to the point of crying in tears in the same night because of something that affected him. And with me being a skeptic, I try to debunk everything, try to find a logical reason. But there's things I've seen and encountered and witnessed that I can't anything other than paranormal. So I think that between the both of us, it's a good combination.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like it's a really good balance between the two of you, one being a little bit more skeptic and the other, you know, experiencing some of these things a little bit more easily.
Right, definitely.
Do you guys think that you experience more like negative spirits and negative energy, or is it, does it tend to be more, I guess, good spirits, or kind of a mix of all of them?
Alan, if you want to take that.
Okay. So as far as feeling things, like where we've investigated, it seems like a lot of those locations tend to be good. The location where he was referring to, where I actually got violently ill, for myself, as far as what I feel, like there are some people out there that they'll say, you know, they hear a spirit talking to them and it's giving them a name and this, that, and the other. That's not something that I'm capable of doing. But if there is a negative energy, that is what, you know, unfortunately, I am really susceptible to feeling. So if it's something that wants to actually hurt somebody, or if it's a very violent, you know, passed on person, those are actually the sensations that I feel. I can feel the anger. I can feel the sadness. I can get the bodily pain to myself. So it's not really the greatest thing that I'm proud of having happen. It's kind of, in a way, it's, I would consider it a dangerous situation for myself. But at least if we're in a situation where I feel, okay, there is something really wrong here, you know, and it's really not safe, then, you know, we would back out if that was the case.
So in a way, it kind of gives you a warning, kind of gives you a heads up.
Yes. And see, like my starting doing the investigation actually goes back to when my parents purchased the house. And the only way I can explain everything in a nutshell is there was demonic activity. And I've had bruises, cuts. I've seen things getting thrown around the house, violently ill. And I started trying to find what was in the house. And from what I found, ended up being more than one entity being there. And, you know, and that's when, you know, years down the road, when me and JP Videos came in contact with each other and I knew that he did the paranormal investigating, I was like, well, you know, I've been around him. I've been in a bad situation. So I'd be interested in doing it. And at least if it is something that's on a demonic level, or if it's just something really unsafe, then I at least can sense and feel when it's time to go or not go.
What are some of the steps that you guys take to try and stay safe in some of these situations? I mean, obviously a lot of you guys are together, so that has to help. But is there any other safeguards that you guys have in place?
Right. So depending on the location, we sometimes do bring extra, I guess you could say, team members with us. We do have a close mutual friend who does come help kind of more on the tech side with handling the gear, transporting things if we have to maneuver around the area. So safety numbers does help. There's even been an investigation at the Knox Mine disaster site over in Pittston, Pennsylvania, where it was a nighttime adventure. And it was kind of a really desolate location. And we brought extra people with us and broke up into teams to work safely together. So in case no one was to fall and get hurt, or no one was to kind of walk and surprise us, because the one thing that we are susceptible to is when we're streaming live, depending on the location, there may be locals watching who know where we are and could potentially show up during the stream to do whatever. So safety numbers is number one. As far as anything for protection from spirits, we do say a protective prayer. It's something that we say at the beginning and the end. Basically what it helps to is to prevent anything or anyone trying to enter your body, or to latch itself onto you, or to follow you home. So it is a protective prayer to help keep us safe and to make sure anything that we're communicating with knows not to latch onto us or to follow us or to come into, you know, into our body or anything like that. Also, if we do carry personal protection, you know, various forms like mace. Alan is, you know, has his own protection on him. So we do take the proper steps to make sure we're doing it safely, and basically just to never do it alone. And common sense goes a long way. If something feels off or not right, you know, we say, okay, let's get out of here. And that's happened before. you know, we heard and encountered stuff and we weren't sure if it was paranormal. We weren't sure if it was people messing with us. And we said, you know what, let's just play it safe. We'll come back another time and pick up with it. And with all those combined, you know, everything has worked out safely for as long as we've been doing it.
So you just mentioned the Knox Mine Disaster site there. You were doing an investigation at. Did anything happen to you there at that site?
Yeah, actually, the first time we went there, I've actually done like a mini documentary on the site when I learned about it several years ago. And we went there close to the anniversary date in January. And myself and Alan did a investigation there. And for the most part, it was relatively quiet for most of the night while we were streaming live and doing our investigation. But towards the end, there was a section of woods, and Alan was actually referring to it, where he heard something, and we weren't sure if it was people. There was a loud thump that happened roughly 10 to 15 yards behind us in the woods. And it sounded literally like a Volkswagen vehicle being dropped from the sky and landing on the ground. It was that loud, almost felt it in the ground. It was something that kind of took us, you know, above surprise, didn't know what to think. We didn't know what to think. You know, we were just shocked. We were kind of speechless. And frankly, we were kind of scared. We didn't know what was going on. And we ended up kind of wrapping things up immediately, rushed out of there, get back to our vehicles. And we came back, I believe, a week later with several people. And that's where we broke off into teams. And we tried to debunk what caused that. I even went back in the daytime to see if there's anything evident of something being thrown or broken, maybe a fallen tree or a boulder, anything. I couldn't find anything that was logical to have made that sound or to give us that experience. But upon returning at night, we broke off into teams. We investigated down near the river. We did it near the air shaft. And we did have a lot of activity, especially with the Jesse doll. We had K2 hits. We had the flashlight going on and off. It was actually pretty active the second time around. But the first time being there with just me and him, we basically were scared out of there. It was just an unbelievable experience. And to this day, I don't know what caused that sound.
So you said that loud thump. Was that actually in the daytime? Because I heard you say you returned back at night with your team.
So it happened during our investigation at night.
Oh, at night. Okay.
We typically do our investigations at nighttime. And I would say it was probably around 9, 10 o'clock p.m. And we were already there for an hour or two when the thump happened, the loud sound. And we left. It was still nighttime. I came back the next day during the daytime just to look around and see what could have possibly caused it. Didn't find anything. And we came back a second time at night and continued investigating. And that sound didn't get recreated, but we did get a lot of activity, though.
Any other investigations that you guys did locally that sort of stuck in your mind?
I'm sure Alan has his own. The other one I can mention is Concrete City in Nanticoke, Pennsylvania. It's where I did my first paranormal investigation live back in 2018. But we returned more recently, I think it was last year. And it was a crazy situation because that area is a known party spot. We got there early to scope out the area. We wanted to pick the locations we were going to investigate. And dozens of people ended up arriving on ATVs and vehicles and trucks, having a big bonfire in a section of the area behind the houses. So we were limited to our access as to where we go. And also, we knew that we were going to have issues with contamination of evidence, you know, with people screaming, yelling, playing music.
Yeah, of course. But especially with a party location there.
Yeah, so it was unfavorable conditions, but we decided to press on and still do it. And that location gave me my best ever flashlight communication interaction. I had my mag light set on the doorstep of one of the concrete houses, and it was going off like it's never gone before. And I ended up making some type of contact and getting several questions answered about them being a coal miner, about them realizing that they are passed on, and that there are others there. But it is by far the best flashlight experience I've ever had as far as communication with something beyond. Aside from that, though, the location itself is just very historic. And being there at nighttime, you know, raises your senses because you don't know, you know, what's in the darkness. But the reason I went back there is because back around 2005, 2006, I did a private investigation there, myself and my fiance at the time. And that's where I witnessed one of my first solid apparitions. I was heading towards one of the concrete houses there. And it was nighttime, probably 7, 8 p.m. in the evening, pitch dark out, had flashlights, had a K2 meter. And I was heading into one of the houses. I stepped up into the concrete floor of it. And looking straight across was another doorway to another room. As I stepped into the house, a black shadow went from right to left, right across the doorway in the other room. It spooked me for a second because I thought someone was in there, but I rushed right towards that room, and it went into a wall. There was nowhere for it to go. No doors, no windows, no nothing. So whatever was in there that passed by in front of that doorway went through a wall. But it was a solid black apparition, almost like a silhouette of someone. But I couldn't make out any details except a black figure walking. But it almost seems like it was hiding out in there, and I startled it. But it went right across the doorway. I saw it with my own eyes, and it disappeared into a wall. And from then on, I've encountered a lot more stuff, very similar, some more creepy than the others. But Concrete City, though, for me, stands out because of the history and the experience that I've had there. But, Alan, do you have any favorites of yours?
Yeah, I would say that my very most favorite and memorable right now was the private residence that we did, which I don't want to actually pinpoint. It's local, but I don't want to give the exact location for it. But basically, the homeowner, funny enough, and this is actually very creepy, she actually had purchased a casket that actually used to have a body in it. The loved ones of the person who was buried actually had the casket along with the body taken out of the ground, and other arrangements were made with the body. And she actually is the owner of a old school Cadillac hearse as well, which is why she bought the casket to basically restore it and, you know, be able to take it to car shows and things like that. But what's weird is the house that we were investigating, this was actually the one where I got really ill, where I felt a lot of sadness and actually got to the point where I felt I was going to bawl my eyes out. But in the back room where she actually had kept the casket, which at the time was taken out of the house, there was a lot of orbs flying around, which actually in, you know, replaying and watching the videos, we could see, and they were just circling me. And the whole time I'm kind of like kneeling on the ground because this was right after I'd actually just gotten sick. But the moment I got sick was actually when we were in the backyard, and I actually went towards the back of her hearse that she had. And she left the keys for us and everything and said, you know, if you guys want to go in it, you know, whatever. Well, we had it unlocked and we actually opened up the back of it. And even though we did a sweep with the K2 meter and nothing really flashed, and usually people say that there's nothing that really holds to anything like that, the moment I opened the back of that door was when I just got hit with this overwhelming, nauseous feeling. And that's, you know, when I started getting sick. But then actually after talking to her, after we got done the investigation, because she didn't really fill us in on a whole lot until afterwards, because she wanted us to experience things, you know, without telling us and kind of contaminating the evidence because we'd be looking for it. But she did say that ever since she brought that casket to the house, there was always the presence of this older man that was in that back room, which was also in the backyard, right where the hearse was sitting.
Jeez. So I know you mentioned with the Knox Mine investigation that you had gotten obviously scared because there was that loud noise. And then you guys have mentioned, of course, the other things that you have experienced physically. But do you guys ever get, like, do you get scared regularly when you guys are at some of these things? Like, if things start getting really intense, and when do you decide to stop and go home?
Well, for me personally, I have a pretty strong presence as a person. So I come across as more of an intimidating person, which helps and can hurt depending on the situation. And the reason I'm saying that is because it takes a lot for me to feel scared or to feel nervous or to be, you know, on edge, because typically I don't encounter many situations that would make me feel that way. There has been times, though, aside from the Knox Mine disaster site, of being physically scared out of there, typically when activity happens, I get excited. I'm almost like a kid in a candy store. I'm like, oh yeah, something's happening. So I don't really get scared. I just get on edge. I'm excited, curious to see what's going to happen next. Now, there was a location that did give me the chills and question if we should continue. We did do a haunted barn behind this farmhouse. And the barn was partially dilapidated, but we were able to go inside of it. And it's one of the key places where we used the laser grid. We were in a particular corner of the barn, had the laser grid in front of us pointing towards this corner of the barn. And during that time, during the investigation, it happened live. Something passed in front of the laser grid multiple times. You could see movement of the laser grids, and that's not supposed to happen unless something is interfering with the lights. And when that started happening, it literally raised what little hairs I have in my head on edge. It really, like, what are we encountering? What's happening right now? Because it's never happened like that. It was very prominent, very evident, and happened at least a half a dozen times. And that, it didn't make me scared, but it made me question, like, if we should continue. I didn't know how ramped up the activity was going to get, but I was more so excited. But typically when stuff happens, though, I don't get scared. If I was to get scared, I don't think I should be doing this. But I think that, you know, having a good, strong presence and being level-headed and calm under pressure kind of helps in this situation. I'm able to kind of ration things out before I make any conclusions. But, Alan, how about you?
I think the only time that I really felt, I guess, creeped out was this one time we actually went into a cemetery and we filmed the cemetery at night. Now, the last portion of it, it was very calm and everything was, you know, okay. But when we first started investigating there, you know, we would have the traditional K2 hits, flashlight hits, but we kept, out of the corners of our eyes, just kept seeing black figures popping up here and there, and the sensation of feeling like there was eyes. And it wasn't a bad feeling, but it was like as if we went in somewhere and people were curious of why we were there and what we were doing. And it was just a very overwhelming curiosity feeling of just so many people staring. And, you know, after a while of doing the investigating, it kind of it settled and, you know, it was a little bit more comfortable. But that was honestly, I would say, the one time where if I was by myself, I probably would have bailed out.
Yeah, I remember that night, too. And a perfect example is if you've seen a movie where, you know, a group of friends walk into like a local bar and, you know, you're the outsider, you're the outcast. Everyone, like, music stops. Everyone turns and looks at you. That's what it felt like. Everyone's just staring at you. You're being watched. They're wondering why you're there, what you're doing. And again, it didn't feel negative or hurtful or dangerous, but it just felt almost like uncomfortable, like just people watching you, but you can't see them. But as he said, the night went on, it kind of dissipated, whether they got comfortable with us or not, but yeah, it's more of an uncomfortable feeling, but not so much scary.
Yeah, they might have just been checking you out to see what the reasoning you were there for.
Yeah, I think that's what it was.
You guys kind of go to a lot of very different places. I mean, you mentioned the barn and personal residences and other places. How do you guys find some of these places that you decide to go to?
A lot of the private residences that we've currently done, it's basically just from knowing people. So, you know, having friends that say like, oh, you know, now you're doing paranormal investigating. You know, I have a friend that has a house, and, you know, or that person has a friend with a house. Yeah, that's kind of how we got into the private residences that we currently have done. We've talked about, you know, also trying to reach out and pretty much expand to where, you know, if there is some sort of advertising where if somebody is having stuff go on at their house, you know, a method where they could contact us and, you know, have us go and, you know, let us do the filming and everything. But unfortunately, the only thing that is really kind of halting any of that right now is just, you know, with the circumstances of what's been going on lately, you know, with the COVID and all that. So that's kind of put a little bit of a damper on doing anyone's actual house. But, you know, even with businesses, there's actually a couple that I've reached out to. And, you know, again, with what's going on, it's kind of holding us back a little bit. But once everything kind of clears away, it would, you know, be nice. And, you know, if somebody finds either of our YouTube channels, they could easily, you know, get our contact information to send us an email, you know, and be able to talk to us about what's going on and, you know, possibly set something up if they want us to do their home
Now, do you guys mostly stick around northeastern central Pennsylvania area, or do you guys sort of travel out more farther out?
Right now, for the time being, we do try to stay local just for convenience. Adults do have families and stuff like that. Also for saving cost of travel expenses. But we actually talked recently about expanding to like basically the tri-state areas, New York, New Jersey, getting out to western Pennsylvania. I have had some of my viewers reach out to me who are out in Ohio and Virginia who do have reported activity at their private residences, but unfortunately, just due to the distance, we haven't been able to make it out there yet. But aside from, you know, finding things publicly through websites and forums and stuff like that, we're also kind of expanding into doing haunted hotels now, too. I did do my first one in Jim Thorpe at the Inn in Jim Thorpe just last month, and it found to be a pretty, I guess you could say, entertaining video to watch. That one I did do recorded because I did an overnight stay. But we're talking about going to reported haunted hotels in Pennsylvania, New York, New Jersey, and basically doing the premise of where I do it live, he does it recorded, and seeing what we find just to kind of get more variety to the locations that we film. But as far as private residences go, we're, like I said, we're open to investigating them if people do want to reach out to us. But we are limited to pretty much Pennsylvania, New York, New Jersey for the time being.
You did mention the Inn at Jim Thorpe there, and they were actually one of our first guests here in the podcast series, and they had some... Definitely had some interesting stories there in the property.
Yeah, and that's the reason I picked that location is just through research, looking for something within an hour or two. And that location came up time and time again on many websites. And I read into the reports from guests there about all the activity that takes place. And I booked myself a room. And now being with, you know, the whole pandemic, hotel rates are really cheap. So I got it at a steal. And I stayed there by myself in my own room, you know, and did a solo investigation, which I typically don't do. I do feel more comfortable doing it with someone, especially with Alan, since we're comfortable working together. But for this particular instance, since it was my first time doing it, I did do a solo overnight investigation. And the video, I mean, speaks for itself. There was a lot of strange things that happened. But the thing that probably startled me the most is around 3 a.m., which I decided to wrap up filming by 2 a.m., I was asleep. 3 a.m., I got woken up by like a loud bang or thud on the wall. It woke me from a dead sleep, and I picked up my camera, you know, and documented it. But as to what caused that, I don't know. But I do know that that hotel in particular is very historical, and a lot of famous people stayed there, and a lot of history with railroading and coal mining. It doesn't surprise me that there's a lot of activity there, and things that have been reported, I do believe, are true, and I've experienced not the same things that are necessarily on websites about TVs turning on and off, furniture being flipped over. But I did hear sound. I did hear a moan in the room. And I did have one of my tools I was using, which was something I traditionally don't use, is a ghost app on my phone. I wanted to try something different. And this app works as an EMF detector and K2 meter and a voice recorder, and basically scans the room for any frequencies, electrical frequencies, and also is able to visually put on the screen what the voice is coming through, like what the name is. So it'll give me names. It'll give me random words. Almost about 20 words came through during that investigation. And it's kind of like putting pieces together to a puzzle. They don't really make sense at first, but we did get a few names. And the one thing that happened without going off track too much here is that when I first started the investigation that night on that app, it came through two words. The first one was fan, F-A-N, and the next word was allow. They both came in within 10 seconds of each other, and immediately the fan in the room kicked on. I don't know if it was a funny coincidence or not, but I'm like, holy crap, what are the chances of this?
Yeah.
So and it was an eventful night. I didn't feel scared there, but I definitely was curious to see what was going to take place, and it's something I'd like to go back and do again as a live investigation.
If anyone's interested in seeing your YouTube channel or contacting you to do an investigation, what's the best way to get in contact with you guys?
For myself, I'm on YouTube and Facebook. All you have to do is search the word JP Videos, one word. If you go to JP Videos, if you want to see my paranormal videos, I do have a playlist, and it's simply called Paranormal. And there you'll find all of my paranormal investigations. To contact me, it's very simple. You could either go under the video description or go to my about page and you will find my email, P.O. box address, everything you need to know to contact me. On Facebook, I'm simply on Facebook as JP Videos 81. So you could either find the link in the description or just search facebook.com/JP Videos 81.
And then, Alan, if anyone's interested in looking up your videos or also get in contact with you for an investigation, how would they do that?
Just go on YouTube and search Revenge of the Apocalypse. And then pretty much the same thing. If you go over to the About tab, you'll be able to see the contact information, which does have a PO box where somebody could send something. Or we also have the email address. And then also in a lot of my newer videos, just write down in the description, sort of including the email, so that way anybody that needs to make a quick, you know, message to me or whatever it is, they can find the email there pretty easy. They're not too computer savvy with knowing how to go through all the tabs. And then I just have a playlist. If you look on the playlist, there you'll be able to find the whole lineup of all the paranormal investigations that we've done.
Perfect. We can link to some of your guys' stuff on our Facebook page too, if you want.
Yeah, sure. That'd be great.
I'd like to thank you guys for joining us tonight.
Oh, it was a great time. I'm glad to be part of the show, and hopefully our, you know, stories that we told help, you know, people realize that, hey, people do believe in what's out there, and if you need help, you could potentially reach out to us.
Absolutely. Sure. Thank you, guys.
All right. Thank you.
Have a great night.
You too.
You too. Thanks.
Thanks for joining us tonight on The Creepy Side of NEPA. As always, don't forget to like, subscribe, and follow us depending on what podcast platform you listen to us on. We also have our YouTube channel, which we are going to be trying to post a little bit more on there, which is just The Creepy Side of NEPA. So be sure to look us up on there and subscribe.
Also, don't forget to like our Facebook page, WNEP's Creepy Side of NEPA. That way you'll always be informed on what we're planning, what we're doing, and also what we have in store for you. Until next time, enjoy The Creepy Side of NEPA.
This has been The Creepy Side of NEPA. If you have a spooky story that took place in northeastern or central Pennsylvania, send it to ghost@wnep.com for your chance to share it on an upcoming episode. We're dying to hear from you.